Good morning and welcome back to the Symposium on Law and Technology here at Stanford Law School. The title of the following panel is Privacy for and from the Digital Person. I'm Jonathan Bright, I'm a third year student here, and it's with great pleasure that I introduce today's speakers. Melissa Holyoke is Solicitor General of the State of Utah. She joined the Utah Attorney General's Office in September 2020, bringing extensive experience as a litigator, prosecutor, and leader. Prior to her appointment as Solicitor General, Holyoke served as President and General Counsel of the public interest law firm Hamilton Lincoln Law Institute and its Center for Class Action Fairness. Clayton Kaczynski is counsel at Lahotsky Keller. He is experienced in managing legal and regulatory frameworks and complex litigation analysis. Before joining Lahotsky Keller, Mr. Kaczynski was general counsel of the Cicero Institute, where he managed legal issues for 5 nonprofit corporations in California and Texas. Mr. Kaczynski was also a member of D.E. Shaw's initial class of litigation investment analysts. Mr. Kaczynski was a law clerk for Justices Anthony Kennedy and Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court of the United States, and Judge Brett Kavanaugh on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Aaron Royston is not on the stage. He was on the program, but he cannot make it today due to a COVID contact. So based on the Stanford rules, he can't be here today. Juan Tontat is co-founder and CEO of Clearview AI, which is based in New York City and has created the next generation of facial recognition technology. Clearview AI's bias-free algorithm can accurately find any face out of 3 billion images it has collected from the public internet. It is used by law enforcement to solve crimes, including financial fraud, human trafficking, and crimes against children. A self-taught engineer, Mr. Tontat was also ranked number 2 guitarist under age 16 in Australia's national Eisteddfod music competition. And lastly, Gabe Ledeen is managing counsel, privacy, and product at Cruise. He has deep experience advising sophisticated technical and business leaders on privacy and issues related to artificial intelligence and machine learning. In 2019, he joined Cruise, a leader in the development of autonomous vehicle technology, to build and manage the privacy and product counseling functions. Gabe began his legal career as an associate at Jones Day after clerking for Judge A. Raymond Randolph on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit.
I guess that's my cue. Let me make sure this works. Good morning. Hello, everybody. Welcome, and thanks for having me here. It's great to get out of the house. I haven't been at an event like this in quite some time, I was remarking earlier, so I hope you'll give me some leeway if this seems a little bit uncomfortable for me initially. But it really is great to be back. I haven't been back to the Stanford campus in quite some time, and this is a great opportunity to connect with a lot of folks. I thought that first panel was extremely insightful and interesting. I learned a ton from it. I just watched a YouTube video a few days ago on NFTs with another partner from A16Z. And I think I'm hooked. I got to figure out my background right now on Zoom is like a bunch of little drawings from my 5-year-old. So I think I need to get out there and need to upgrade, I think. So today's panel on privacy, you know, really one of the things I love most about privacy, being a privacy practitioner, is that it covers such a wide expanse of interesting issues. So the title of the panel is, you know, somewhat vague, and I think that's really to enable us to have a lot of flexibility and kind of follow the discussion wherever it goes. You know, we have really amazing, incredible, and interesting panelists here, so I'm going to do my best to get out of the way and enable them to share their insights with us, really. But I'll just start off by mentioning, you know, I've been in-house now for six plus years focusing on privacy and product counseling issues, and I've been really drawn to artificial intelligence. And that's you know, not an accident. There's a real confluence between you know, the issues in the privacy space of consumer protection and issues presented more and more through technologies enabled by artificial intelligence. One of the things that I have found is that as an in-house privacy lawyer, we have to be very pragmatic. So we have to be constantly thinking, about what are today's regulations, what are today's requirements, what are some big examples of companies, competitors who have stepped in it, made mistakes, and paid a price for it, and how do we avoid doing that, and how do we look ahead? How do we look ahead and foresee sort of what the next big privacy issue will be? Because really, we tend to be surprised by them, not just in-house at the company, but also I think just as a society. The new developments of technology are continuous. I think Sal mentioned that earlier. There's a bit of a lag, right? You have continuous technological advancement and development, and those technologies are developed and deployed under the existing legal regime. And many times, and I think more and more, as the technology accelerates, it's done in an environment where the regulatory framework really obviously didn't contemplate the technology, and in many cases is really poorly equipped to manage the new technology. So I say, my parents in particular love to say, well, privacy is dead. You hear this a lot. Privacy is dead. It's been long gone. Whatever notion we had of privacy, is long dead. But what I say and what I really believe is, some version of privacy is probably dead. The notion that you had at that time, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, of what privacy was, probably is dead. But now it's something else. It's been reimagined, it's been rediscovered, it's been recreated, to reflect new technologies, new capabilities, and now we have new regulations really to respond to those developments. So if privacy is dead, nobody's told the regulators, because I think nowadays, at least as an in-house privacy lawyer, the job is more complicated, more difficult today than it has been in the past, as we have really, as technology is accelerating, we're also seeing an acceleration in regulation. So, whether it's at the state level here or globally, so you see in California as a lawyer practicing here, the new CCPA and the CPRA, closely following. You see laws, mimicking or mirroring some of those issues, in Virginia and Colorado. You see other states, including Utah, innovating in the space, developing new privacy laws to focus more on specific issues, for that jurisdiction. And globally, you see, obviously Europe has innovated in the regulatory space for quite some time with GDPR and the e-privacy directive. And now you see also other countries, including Brazil and Japan, very important markets, enacting pretty serious privacy regimes that companies have to take seriously, and they're beginning enforcement. So privacy, fascinating space. The discussion will probably vary, and that's fine. I think that reflects sort of the nature of the material. But I do want to try and focus on a couple of issues that I think are relevant for the group, including where we say privacy for and from the digital person. I think what's reflected there is this notion that on the one hand, we're concerned about privacy of the customer, privacy of individuals, privacy of individuals, and protecting them from what? And there's a notion also of the bifurcation there between safety of concerns that sometimes, and I think one of the panelists is going to talk about, at least one, probably more than one, talk about this this dilemma between protecting people and protecting information from investigators, from government agencies who might be able to help remediate some of those or prevent some of those safety issues. So with that as by way of an introduction, I'd love to kick it to the panelists. The format will be, each person will talk for however long they want. I think the idea is somewhere like 8 to 10 minutes, but each person will talk, and then we'll have a roughly 30-minute conversation that I'll try and facilitate, and open it up for questions from all of you. So as folks are talking, hope you have a pen or a phone or a tablet or any number of other devices, jot down your thoughts, get some questions ready for the Q&A portion at the end. So maybe Clayton, would you like to kick us off with some of your thoughts?
Surprised. All right. Yeah, I'm Clayton Kaczynski, really pleased to be here. This is, you may not have done this in a while, but this is my first time, so I'm excited, and cut me some slack, bye.
Keep it up.
So there's this story that was going around a little while ago about how Target's advertising algorithm was able to detect that a young teenage girl was pregnant just based off of her shopping patterns, and they started sending pregnancy-related coupons to her house. So her dad, who was not in on this yet, storms into the Target one day and starts giving him the business about encouraging his young teenage daughter to have a baby. The next day, the manager calls the dad's house to apologize, and the dad picks up the phone and sort of sheepishly admits that maybe he didn't totally know what was going on under his own roof. Unfortunately, the story's not true. I looked it up before I got here. But it is a good story, and I think it makes an interesting point. You know, privacy is a little bit difficult to value. I think that we all know that we like it to some extent, but you know, it's kind of hard to articulate exactly why. And if you do have a very good reason for liking privacy, you probably don't want to share it. you know, we talk about civil liberties when we defend them, often in terms of their social utility. Speech, for instance, you know, it can be very dangerous and destabilizing. When Terry Jones in Florida burned a stack of Qurans in the early 2000s and put it on YouTube, people rioted in Afghanistan and people died as a result. So, you know, when speech activists are dealing with this tension, they will, you know, talk about the marketplace of ideas, the value of an open discourse to a democracy. They don't talk about how, you know, philosophically lovely it is to have a gab. They talk about the social utility of the civil liberty. When gun nuts like myself talk about the value of the Second Amendment, we don't talk about how awesome guns are, even though they are obviously extremely cool. We talk about, you know, how guns protect our families, they protect ourselves, and they can even protect our country against the most aggressive intrusions of our government, you know, if needs be. Privacy is a little bit different because, you know, it's hard to defend in terms of how it serves society. But I'm just gonna come out and say it, I support privacy. I like it, I'm privacy queen even. I'm a maximalist maybe. But I recognize that there are tensions. And so, you know, as I've been thinking through these tensions, I've been thinking of two innovations specifically that have come to mind. One is facial recognition. And one is the legal innovation of geofence and search term warrants. When it comes to facial recognition, you know, I've actually had the pleasure of using extremely cutting edge, high quality facial recognition software, and I'll tell you, it's amazing. You know, imagine being able to just, you know, basically do a Google search on anybody who is walking down the street, or who's sitting next to you in a plane, or who shows up on your dating app. You know, it's awesome. And you get the sense, as soon as you do it, that it is not going anywhere. It's too powerful, it's too interesting, it's too useful, and you know, it's inevitable. And I actually think that that's a good thing. You know, facial recognition by itself has a great potential for social utility versus personal intrusion. You know, for one thing, it's incredibly effective at catching what many people believe to be the worst types of criminals, pedophiles. And even outside of the sort of sphere of criminal justice, you know, it's gonna revolutionize our lives as we start to implement it in a variety of different places. They already have grocery stores where you can load up your cart, you know, walk in, load up your cart, and push it right out the door without ever taking out your wallet or interacting with a teller. And you're gonna have to take my word, they hate it when you do that at a regular grocery store. It's gonna be great, it's gonna be a great new world. If police don't wanna catch looters, the grocery store could just send them a bill. But, you know, of course we do have to draw lines. I would very much like to avoid a situation where the government can track our every move just, you know, based on surveillance equipment that is coupled with facial recognition. And the idea of it just kind of creeps me out. It gives me the heebie-jeebies. And if you think that sounds far-fetched, well, they are already doing this in China and even, you know, our cousins in the United Kingdom. So it can happen if we let it. On the legal innovation, the geofence warrants and the search history warrants, location warrants allow police to demand that tech companies hand over cell phone app location data of a certain place at a certain time. Search term history warrants, they allow police to get a comprehensive record of everybody who has looked up a specific key term. Now, I actually think that the geofence warrants are okay, the location warrants are okay. So, you know, to give you an example, let's say a guy is shot at a gas station up the street at 2 a.m., and that's all the police know. They can go to the tech companies, and they can demand that the tech companies hand over all of the app location data that they have from, say, 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. for that place. It's a narrow, you know, it's a narrow location over a narrow period of time. The keyword warrants, I think, are kind of a different thing altogether. I'll give you an example of how these work from the real world. So earlier this year, police arrested quintessential Florida man, Michael Williams, for witness intimidation after they discovered that he had set fire to a witness's car. They initially became suspicious of him when his name showed up on a short list of people who had looked up the witness's address in the period of time leading up to the crime. You know, their suspicion was not diminished when they found out that he had also looked up where to buy a 50 caliber machine gun, countries that don't have extradition to the United States, and perhaps most damningly of all, several instances of looking up the term witness intimidation. I have to admit, I'm kind of curious to see the WikiHow on that now that we talk about it. You know, I'm glad they caught Michael. He seems like a bad guy. But I'm still not totally comfortable with this being in the arsenal of investigators and prosecutors. And if I had to think about a thread that runs through my intuitions on all of this, I'd call it the superhero test. You know, on the one hand, you have things that, you know, technological innovations that make the things that we can already do easier. And on the other hand, you have technological innovations that basically give us superpowers. And if, you know, believe it or not, I would argue that this same intuition is already reflected in Supreme Court's Fourth Amendment jurisprudence in cases like Kylo and Carpenter and Riley and a few others. You know, facial recognition, it's powerful, but it's not magic. If police have a picture of you committing a crime, they can distribute it around, they can find somebody to ID you. You know, that's a classic police tool. And in fact, given how unreliable, you know, witness identifications are, I think this is actually really a step in the right direction. It's a different thing when we give police the power to, you know, to track pretty much anybody anywhere in a city center with no more effort than pushing a single button. You know, to me, that's a superpower. Geofence warrants, the location warrants, you know, it's not magic. You had somebody who witnessed a crime, you could get the same information. If police saw a crime, you can get the same information. You know, it's information about who was at a specific location at a specific time. It's, you know, it's powerful, it has a lot of social utility, but it's not magic, and I think that the extent to which it invades into our privacy is not that significant. You know, the keyword searches, to me, you know, this is kind of the worst innovation of all. You know, the ability for the government to peer into the homes of anybody who researches a specific keyword at practically any given time, I mean, to me, that's not just magic. That is, you know, terrifying authoritarian magic. That is the kind of thing that Stalin would have given his mustache for. And, you know, I think we should be incredibly careful about how we integrate this particular piece of voodoo into our society. So, you know, I think my intuition will ultimately be borne out as these cases work their way through the courts, and some of these questions are working their way through the courts. If not, I'd like to see legislation to draw these lines, because that's kind of the society that I want to live in. And I would say, you know, when you're thinking about these questions, think about the Superman test. Thank you.
Thank you, Clayton. Juan?
Hi, my name is Juan Tontat. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Clearview AI. Thanks for having me here. It's an honor to be at the Federalist Society. I thought my first university speech would be at a computer science thing. So yeah, it's what we do. There's a few misconceptions about facial recognition in general, mainly because of what you see in the movies. It's not a real-time thing, the way Clearview AI deploys it. So typically an investigator, they have a photo from surveillance of someone they cannot identify. So one example was Homeland Security in 2019. They had a photo of an adult man in the background of a child abuse video. And this person was abusing a six-year-old girl and selling it online. And they couldn't find him for 2 or 3 months. So I got a call a few months later when they used Clearview to find him, and the only photo they could find of him was a publicly available social media post, and it was someone else's photo. He's in the background in the mirror working at a gym. So given that clue, which is the only thing we had in our database at the time, they were able to go down to the gym owner, ask him, hey, who's this person? They didn't give out information. They eventually got it when they realized the severity of the crime. He's now doing 35 years in jail, and they could save a six-year-old girl. So when I hear stories like this every day from our customers, it keeps us really inspired to keep providing our services. So that's kind of like the investigative process, which I learned law enforcement does. When there's a crime and there's a photo and they can't identify it, they put it through our search engine. By contrast, China, they deploy a lot of real-time surveillance all the time. And like Clayton said, I think you can just follow someone around the whole entire day without a warrant. So technology doesn't exist all by itself. I think it always has to be integrated into society. And in our world, we value things like presumption of innocence and due process and all that. And so when we develop our technology, we're always trying to find the best way and the best use cases and engage in debate about it and also show some examples. So we've been pleasantly surprised about how law enforcement has been able to use it to solve all kinds of crimes. The FBI were able to triple their rate of victim identification. So when you arrest a pedophile, sometimes there's about 1,000 photos of kids on their hard drive that they don't know who they are, these victims. And you could be living in a really nice, safe neighborhood. You could have everything going just fine, but your child could be abused online. They call it sexploitation over the course of years. And so they're able to triple their rate of IDing the victims. They might find them in a school photo or at band practice or at soccer practice, and then get to the parents and help these children recover and once their predator has been locked up. So it's been really interesting kind of having a sneak peek behind the scenes in terms of how this technology is actually used. We're always engaging with other people to find the best kind of regulation around it, because it's really powerful. But I truly believe that this technology is going to be a very big enabler of safety in the coming years, because I think any society needs the ability to identify someone, good actors, bad actors, and things like that, in order to stay safe. So I guess thanks for having me on the panel.
Thank you.
Melissa.
Good morning. I'm Melissa Holyoke. I'm the Utah Solicitor General. I'll start with the disclaimer that my comments are not the official position of the Attorney General's office. Unless you think I'm brilliant, then yes, they are. But so why is the Solicitor General here? Well, I oversee criminal appeals, civil appeals, our constitutional defense, but also our antitrust and our data breach privacy enforcement division. We have one of those first generation laws, the Personal Information Act, and it's really designed to penalize the lack of sufficient security measures or people that just don't get rid of obsolete databases or wipe old computers. But it's the definition of personal information is someone's first, last name, plus a social security number, financial account, credit card. So it is a first generation data breach privacy law. We don't require any notification. So oftentimes we learn about this from a complaining customer or because of our cooperation on the NAG task force. NAG is the National Association of Attorneys General, and we work with them on multi-state investigations and lawsuits. And this becomes important because states, there really is a patchwork of regimes out there. I might get stoned at a Federalist Society event for suggesting that it might be nice to have just one law, federal law, that applies in this situation. I am a big proponent of states as laboratories and creating state laws, but it is very difficult for companies to navigate around this patchwork of competing regimes. There is, just recently, the Uniform Law Commission passed a draft Uniform Personal Data Protection Act. This just came out a few months ago, and it will likely be presented to legislatures around the country this following year. And I could spend the entire day on that, but I did want to touch just on a few aspects of this act. It's different. It's not just data breach. It's about data subjects' personal data use and how that's obtained, online interactions, and how companies will use that data and obligations around that. It specifically departs from many U.S. laws, including in the prefatory note, it says that this is trying to avoid the regulatory costs and compliance costs associated with the California and Virginia regimes, which are quite difficult, as some industry experts would say. What's interesting is that there is a definition for sensitive data, and it includes race and ethnic, gender, citizenship, immigration, real-time geolocation, criminal record, or genetic sequencing information. And so for this data, it requires that the user have written opt-in consent for the company to use it in any incompatible way. And so incompatible is defined as anything that's not compatible. And compatible is defined as anything that's not consistent with the ordinary expectation of the data subject. Of how does the person expect this data to be used? What's also very interesting about this Uniform Act is it doesn't cover publicly available information, but how they define that publicly available information is information on websites even where there is restricted access, if the information is available to a broad audience. And what is a broad audience? That's going to be all good questions if these acts get passed in certain states. So when I was looking at this act, I think some of the questions come up is, what needs protection, right? There's the sensitive data. It's an emerging concept. And I thought about some of these cases that I've been involved in and that have been recently resolved. A few years ago, as Gabe mentioned, I was the president of a public law interest firm, and we challenged unfair class actions. And we were involved in a challenge of a Google class action settlement. And the underlying issue related to Google taking Google search queries and giving them to third parties. So our objection actually didn't involve that, but involved the class action settlement and the structure. But we ended up taking that to the Supreme Court, and in front of the Supreme Court, they were very interested in the actual injury and the underlying question. And my colleague argued the case. I was sitting at counsel's table, and I remember the colloquy between, I think, the United States arguing at the time, discussing whether there was actually an injury to someone whose search terms were being given to third parties. Some of the justices were saying, well, but they're looking for public information. And I scribbled furiously on my notepad, but it's the search that's private. And almost immediately, your judge, Justice Kavanaugh, said almost exactly right after that, but isn't the injury the disclosure of the search terms? So same wavelength, Justice Kavanaugh gets it. I'm sure you get it too. We like our searches private, and I think it's the expectation when you are going into Google, you throw in a search, I think we just think it magically kind of disappears into the universe after we create the search. But there is an injury there. And just this last year, another case that I was thinking about is the Americans for Prosperity versus Bonta. And this case came out of a California requirement. So in California, if you're a nonprofit and you want to solicit charitable donations in California, you need to register with the state. And every year, you need to file your IRS tax form, which includes a Schedule B, the list of all of your donors. So as a president of a nonprofit, I did not like this. And I even tried to submit it without that Schedule B, but they would not process my form. And I'm just mad that I didn't sue like AFP. And but so one nonprofit decided to sue the state, and it went up to the Supreme Court. And what they showed was that California said, oh, this is necessary for fraud. And there were other ways that California could actually investigate the fraud. But what was interesting is that thousands of documents were listed on the California Attorney General's website, which included all of this information. And one of the experts at trial just had to do a tiny little, added one digit to the URL, and hundreds of thousands of more documents showed up with all of this information. So the risk was there. And in a 6-3 decision, they reversed the Ninth Circuit. And what the Supreme Court noted was the vital relationship between freedom to associate and the privacy in one's associations. They relied heavily on an NAACP versus Alabama case where the Attorney General had sought membership lists of the NAACP. And of course, that was, the Supreme Court said, absolutely no way. And same here, where the donors' lists were private. It would chill the association. It's vital, the freedom to associate and privacy in one's association. So just this last month, I've been thinking about those cases when I read an article about a data breach hack for Epic. I don't know if you are familiar with Epic. Epic is a registrar, web hosting company. It's known for providing services to websites that host far right, like Gab, Parler, Proud Boys. I always want to say Parlay. It's French. Come on, right, people? Anyway, what was interesting is that what was noted was the hack was described as a Rosetta Stone for the far right, because it allowed researchers and journalists to discover links between far-right websites, groups, and individuals. This, to me, was very scary. I am like Clayton. I do strongly believe in the privacy. I think there needs to be, but I also have read some of what you've written about the First Amendment rights in the facial recognition. And there needs to be a good balance. We need to allow innovation from companies. We want the Clearviews. We want the Cruises of the world to innovate and to come up with these amazing technologies. We need to be also concerned with our citizens' privacy and in the law enforcement and in other settings. So I guess the question is, when these come before your state legislatures, and I just enforce, I'm not going to write the law, but maybe if you have influence in that area, should this sensitive data include other protections? Our freedom to associate? Are we concerned about that? Are there protections out there that are needed so that the freedom to associate is not chilled? That's all I have.
Thank you. So I'd like to pick up actually right where you left off, Melissa, with the connection between the freedom of association and privacy. I think I see a path to segue there into the facial recognition context, which is the context of protests, right? So in a way, I think political protests or social protests sort of epitomizes this notion of freedom of association, right? You're coming together with other citizens, with other members of your community to express a concern about a topic that's affecting everyone. And so you're coming together and in a very, often public way to express a concern. And it's over the last year or year and a half, we've seen some of these kinds of protests. There have then been raised a number of concerns about the use of surveillance technology to identify people who have participated in those protests. Not necessarily because people have been trying to hide their identities by wearing masks or taking other measures, but simply, you know, because I think historically we haven't gone out of our way. We haven't taken, you know, significant efforts to identify, for example, hundreds or thousands of people by person, you know, by name, who have participated in a protest. And, you know, you could, this isn't, you know, a partisan issue. You can take, you know, the two obvious examples are, you know, January 6th and some of the, you know, Black Lives Matter protests, right? You could frame that as, you know, two very different, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum, or different populations, different groups, you know, voicing different kinds of concerns, but both, interestingly, you know, raising concerns about encroachment on their privacy, in particular by law enforcement trying to identify, you know, members of, who have been participating there. So I'm, you know, curious about your thoughts there. You know, do you think that's a significant risk today? Do you think, you know, that rises to a level of serious concern? And I, you know, move down the line here to see, you know, what you think about when you, and you can, you know, feel free, and I would encourage you to layer on the facial recognition technology, right? Where not only do you have surveillance cameras operating, you know, often in public spaces now, almost ubiquitous in some cities, then you layer on the capability to use facial recognition software to identify, you know, people who are participating in those protests, some of whom may have criminal backgrounds, but many of them don't. You know, just regular citizens gathering together.
Oh, I think that scares me. I think there is a distinction between using facial recognition software after the fact and live scan, whereas there is capability out there, like to, as in real time, to be able to recognize faces, and that seems very scary, especially on a protest. On the facial recognition end, we do have a law in Utah that it does throw up some guardrails for our law enforcement. Particularly the technology that they're using, that it's not antiquated, so that it will have good results. And also some accountability. What is this being used for? So I can understand in protests in general, why do you need to use that for facial recognition for protest? Absolutely, you do not have a reason, unless it extends beyond that and there is a crime that is committed. I think what's interesting about the facial recognition software that is being used, the law enforcement does have to have some accountability on who's using it, where it's being, for what purpose, and training as well, to make sure that they aren't using it with any, I don't know, nefarious intent. But anyway, Clayton?
The January 6th, you know, protest, riot, whatever it was, is a kind of the perfect storm of all of these technologies together. There's some good articles by TechDirt and Wired about not only using facial recognition, but using the geofence location warrants and even the keyword warrants to just, you know, really drill down on these guys. You know, that particular protest got a lot of traction and has a lot of momentum behind it, arresting those people, so whatever. You know, when it comes to using this at a sort of, you know, on your average protest that doesn't turn into some kind of a riot, I think it's uncomfortable, particularly if the government's the one doing it. You know, if somebody has a picture of a protest and they want to use their, you know, their facial recognition software to analyze who was in this protest, and it's, you know, they're just a private citizen, and they want to go and write an article and release that information. I kind of think you take that risk when you publicly protest against something, and you put yourself out there as a supporter, you know, you put yourself out there as a body that's going to add to the force of the crowd, you put yourself out there as a, you know, somebody else who believes in this cause. I think there's reasonable steps that we could do to keep people from feeling so intimidated by the government's use of this that they don't want to protest if we think that these protests are good. You know, I think the same thing about, and this is a little bit tangential to that, but I think the same thing about making people, you know, disclose political donations. I think that also discourages people, and it's kind of an obnoxious thing. I did a fundraiser recently, and, you know, you would be surprised how many people were not willing to attend or not willing to donate, because not because they didn't believe in the cause, not because they didn't want to support us, but because they just didn't want their name on a list out there as donating to a Republican. So, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a really important issue, especially when everyone's learning how this technology can be used. At Clearview AI, we don't want this to be used on any kind of peaceful protest, left wing, right wing, at all. It's really only used for after the crime investigations. So we put a lot of effort into adding controls on the technology. So now before anyone can do a search on the platform, they put in a case number, they put in a crime type. The agencies want this too. They want to keep the technology. So if you're running a program or you're in charge, you want to make sure that they're using it for the right purpose. So they can go in and audit who's been using it for what. So the investigators, they know that it's being tracked, and there still can be more progress made on that front. Just because it's logged doesn't mean they're always going to be using it correctly or incorrectly, but at least there's something there. We've thought of different ideas to do more monitoring on that stuff. So maybe one investigator is sending or uploading too many photos with photos of crowds, and that can alert the administrator. So I think that it's something that we care a lot about in terms of making sure it's used for its intended purpose, which is to help identify criminals. And so a lot of the agencies we work with, we push them to have a facial recognition policy, and they publish it on their website. What do we use it for and what we don't use it for? And some of them have it in there saying, we do not want to use this in any way to monitor or identify protesters. However, if a crime does happen, then we will use facial recognition. So as one of many tools to help identify who someone is. I think we definitely are not, as a society, interested in anything like China or what they do for monitoring Uyghurs over there, where there is just no due process whatsoever. And I think that as we learn more about it, we can really get the best out of technology, which is some of the stories I shared with you before. When you're able to identify child predators like that or money launderers, we also used for the January 6th insurrection. So many of these agencies could identify the rioters immediately. And I think that kind of showed, we had a lot of criticism from others, but it helped show another side to facial recognition where a lot of people come around on the issue in terms of, because that was such a big event. And it was something, instead of going through hours of footage or going through the tip lines, they were able to identify people right away. So I think as we learn more about the technology and, as a society, what's acceptable and what's not, I think people can understand the really good use cases of it, and then we can be super proactive in terms of preventing any kind of misuse. Because I do think freedom of association is really important, freedom of speech is really important, and you should be able to go to a protest and not have any kind of worry or concern there.
Thank you. Thank you. Juan, I'll stick with you for a moment. So, the previous panel was talking about, regulations and opportunities, and about, how in some cases the more difficult it is to break in or the more complicated a regulatory framework is, the greater the potential returns. I'm curious, facial recognition as a concept isn't new, and in fact, is already regulated in certain jurisdictions, including in the United States. When you were developing your technology and your initial product, was that something that was specifically in mind for you? Was that how much of an issue was that upfront for you of having to wrestle with those regimes and requirements?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm a technologist by background, not a lawyer, so I wasn't, reading Supreme Court briefs and things like that. I was aware of certain cases around data scraping, like LinkedIn versus HiQ. And so we were always also thinking about the appropriate use. So even before anyone knew about Clearview AI, they were administrators for each agency where they could go through and audit things. And we were always focused on, law enforcement and security purposes to solve crime. So we had a mind about it. And then what made us different in the marketplace was we were able to collect, and that's now over 10 billion photos with faces in this database, and they're all publicly available. So this is stuff that other people have posted voluntarily online. It could be a mugshot site or it could be news websites. And it's also very accurate. So it can pick out a face out of 10 billion faces super accurately. So for law enforcement, it was huge. They were able to take that. And when we gave it to one agency when they started, they said, come back. And I came back in 2 weeks. and they had 20 leads on identity theft cases for people stealing an identity, going to then get a replacement debit card or cash out a check, and they were able to steal other people's money. That case ended up with $35 million in fraud recovered. And then the next week, they came back and said, check this out, we arrested a pedophile who was going to a 12-year-old girl online and suggesting they have sex. So it was kind of amazing, but what made us different, again, is the data set we have. A lot of these other providers didn't have any, and it does bring up kind of issues regarding data privacy and collection. And the other part that kind of gets people is like it's all publicly available. This is stuff that people have voluntarily posted online at one point or another. And I think that's the part that is kind of counterintuitive for people. This is not a database of private information. The amount of information on the internet that people are posting all the time is just ginormous. And so, yeah, we're always thinking about the right kind of regulation and a kind of approach to things. There's an interesting story recently. I think it was some state where they accidentally publicized all the social security numbers and names of people. And the response on Twitter and the media was like, oh, these guys are idiots. It's publicly available now. You know, a little different from Clearview AI because, you know, we had initially, I think, a pretty negative reaction, but we've been able to show people the positive use cases, like the January 6th Capitol riots and others. And I feel that people are coming around now to, it's here to stay. Governments need it, you know, banking institutions need it, people need it for identification and safety, and what kind of regulations and methods do we want to use it? Do we want to use it after the fact, or do you want to use it real time? Especially when you look to countries like China, who are just deploying it rapidly, not just in China, but now in other parts of the world.
Great. You mentioned accuracy, mm-hmm. And it seems to me that in the case of, you know, law enforcement uses of FaceRec, accuracy can be maybe the most important issue given the potential impact on somebody of being incorrectly identified. How do you think about accuracy? Like how do you think about what level of accuracy is enough?
Yeah, I think there needs to be, you know, high standards of accuracy. So when facial recognition came out a long time ago, I guess Facebook, you'd tag your friends. You only have to be accurate out of 1,000, 2,000 friends, or however many you had, right? With the iPhone, it's only one-on-one matching, so you don't have to be there. So we've done some tests that show over 99.6% accuracy on one out of a million search. And when we've got it working, it's kind of amazing. The more data we add to the system, the better it is. So I think that's one part of it, but people have to keep in mind that it's not... I don't really believe in automated decision making, right? So when a result comes back, you still have to click the link and find the name of the person. It's the beginning of an investigation. And I think that it's just philosophically, we should always be in control of our technology. And I think that's a real fear that people have, is that technology is automatically making decisions for us. I don't think we want to live in that kind of world either. So certain things we've done, other facial recognition technology would have a percentage match score, 99%, 98%. We actually removed that. So the investigator has to do his work to do it. And I think training is a major part of that too, right? Training people on how to make sure that they are using the data appropriately, that they get more than just a match on facial recognition to make an arrest. Right, so a lot of these cases, sometimes the one, the guy in the background in the mirror, there's no name associated with them. The investigator has to go then and do his work there. So I think that there's always corroborating evidence. So we don't recommend facial recognition match scores, anything like that to be used as evidence in court. You can compare that to eyewitness testimony, which is actually possible to use. So I think that's how we're trying to be careful about how it's deployed and go from there.
Great. I think that's really helpful. I mean, you mentioned automated decision making, which is a legal term, you mm-hmm. know, in many jurisdictions, including in the EU, you know, under GDPR, a privacy regulation, in Article 22, I think, you know, has requirements for automated decision making that stand apart from other forms of processing of personal information. And the new draft regulation on AI talks a lot about, you know, similar things, right, in terms of risk rating an mm-hmm. AI system. If it's fully automated versus human in the loop.
Yeah. And I'll just mention that my prosecutors would tell you, I think that's one of the biggest misnomers with this, that it just leads automatically to arrest. It's just it's a tool, it's a lead, and you would be remiss to, like, you have to still prove X, Y, and Z even to make an arrest. So it's similar to, you know, you have a photograph and you're taking it door to door. It just speeds up that process.
Clayton, does that alleviate some of your concerns? You know, if investigators, law enforcement, are only using the technology to develop leads, and then they further corroborate using other methods.
It depends on the technology that we're talking about. You know, I think if it's facial recognition, then yes, many of them. I think it would be smart to develop a national framework for how we allow the use of facial recognition technology. Can it just be a lead? Can it be introduced in court? In what instances can it be introduced in court? I'm not sure that I think that this is the right, this is the right technology to build by sort of state patchwork and kind of see what floats and what doesn't. I think there are some lines that probably most of us know we don't want to cross, and there are some things that are probably pretty acceptable. I think if it comes to, keyword searches, no, it doesn't alleviate my concerns at all. There are, aside from just privacy concerns, I think there are very significant First Amendment concerns here. You know, nobody goes to a library to do research anymore. You don't go to a book and look stuff up and write stuff out by hand. Research now is Google, and Wikipedia, and, you can build off of there. You know, maybe if you're writing if you're writing a thesis paper, you'll actually pull a book out at some point, but I wrote a lot of papers in college and I didn't pull out a lot of books for them.
He's younger than me.
So, I think this, we talk about the sort of chilling effect of a law that's not even targeted at speech. I think this is a very serious implication there. If you know that at any time, anything you're looking up, whether it's because you think you're curious or you're funny or you're writing something that has to deal with some macabre subject, at some point something bad might happen and then you're on a police list of people who look this up, that does not alleviate my concern that they might not just, there's an intermediary process before they charge you.
Yeah, I think also everyone has a pretty good idea of what's private and what's public, right? Even as technology has advanced dramatically, with the advent of the newspaper, then the internet, and now phones, everyone's got a camera, right? Everyone's kind of conscious, hey, this is public, this is private. And I think that distinction we all need to have, and that sense of privacy for things that you want to keep private, for sure. Yeah,
I mean, when you talk about the privacy of Google search, contents, for example, I haven't delved deep into the subject of the keyword search warrants. Definitely very concerning, but I do sort of instinctually thinking of the third party doctrine there, yep. Right? I mean, to some extent, right? Shouldn't the individual be on notice there is a third party involved here. There is a service, there is a company that's providing, these search results, and you are, consciously and knowingly providing information to them. Where sort of, does this new technology really put a lot of pressure on third party doctrine?
It does, but, this may not be the right statement for this crowd either, but I think to some extent the frameworks that we develop depend on the things that we're capable of doing when we develop those frameworks.
Right.
What Arthur C. Clarke said, any piece of technology that's sufficiently advanced will be indistinguishable from magic. The idea that this is how things are going to be done, that this is how research is going to be conducted, it's normal to us, but it's kind of a really bizarre thing if you think about it in the abstract, and certainly it's not in the minds of people who were building out these frameworks. And so I think at a certain point, you enter a new paradigm, and you have to go back to first principles and say, does this framework really protect the things that we want to protect anymore? And if it doesn't, then I think you need to start over or risk breaking the framework. And I think that we are entering territory now, technological advances that are so magical that they will break our frameworks if we don't adapt to accommodate them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a, I agree with a lot of what you just said. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, you put a lot on, you know, how advanced the technology is, but I also think you can put a lot on how ubiquitous it is. I mean, there's very little and increasingly less what we do on a day-to-day basis that is completely divorced from the internet and completely independent of, you know, third parties. You know, to say, you know, there's some, we don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy for information that we provide to a third party. Essentially, to me, these days seems a lot like we shouldn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy really in anything, because there's virtually always a third party involved nowadays. Which brings me, you know, which raises for me, the topic of Utah's law, setting a higher bar, a higher standard for law enforcement seeking information about customers from third parties. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, we were the first state to require this, and it was back in 2019, and it requires a warrant with a probable cause to get stored data, transmitted data, basically anything on the cloud, but also location information. What's interesting about our law is that it actually went beyond what the federal law does in the Stored Communications Act. So if we want any subscriber information, we need to use an investigative subpoena, which is more difficult than what the federal government requires, which is just a subpoena, administrative subpoena.
Yeah, so potentially a model there, you know, to sort of close a significant gap, what we're looking at here.
And we've seen a lot of statutes that have come through. Not all of them have passed. We had a statute actually a few years ago, almost at about the same time this was being passed, that would have prevented any sort of biometric information to be used to open a phone. So you have the warrant to open the phone, or you have the warrant to get the information on the phone, but you can't use the biometrics to open the phone. And in fact, we're actually, we have a case right now pending in front of the Utah Supreme Court, because now the question is, okay, can you require the person to use a passcode? Is that violate the Fifth Amendment? So that's an interesting issue, and maybe I'll get up to the Supreme Court on that one. Mm-hmm. We'll see. But we also had another statute that did not get passed, but I assume will be coming back quite often, about geofence, being able to warrants. And it was proposed that you just were not able to use that at all. I think we have really good practices and use best practices in this area in terms of requiring multiple steps and what you have to prove. The first one being it's anonymized completely. Like, so at your gas station example, 1 a.m, you'd still have anonymous data, and then you would, let's say there were 5 or 6 people there. But we know that the defendant or the alleged person, criminal, was there at, you know, 5 minutes before the crime and left 5 minutes after, then you could basically hone down onto that person and maybe even a couple more, and then you could expand into beyond that geofence and see some of the activities, and then on the third final step, finally get the information and the identity. So we have been implementing best practices in those areas as well.
Hmm. So sort of a compromise solution where you don't ban the technology, you know, altogether, or ban law enforcement use of it, but you create a more robust framework recognizing the sensitivity.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, in the face rec context, it seems like it's an all or nothing situation right now. Am I right there? I mean, you've got a number of jurisdictions in the United States that have a small number, but a number that have just outright banned the use of facial recognition software by law enforcement, in some cases any government agency, right? Mm-hmm. And then most other jurisdictions are relatively, if not totally, silent on the subject.
Yeah, it's still a new area. I think there's 4 states that have biometric regulation, so that's fingerprints, facial recognition, and I think in all the statutes there's always an exception for government usage and law enforcement. And, you know, what we also do is publicly available information, so we also have a First Amendment argument around the collection, dissemination of this data. I think it's quite different in terms of expectations of privacy when you're looking up something on Google Maps or you're doing a search for something on Google. You're expecting that to be private, as opposed to you're at an event like this one and someone takes a photo and perhaps they write an article about it. There is a completely different expectation of privacy there. So I think that the things like to geofencing stuff, which I'm not an expert in, and things like that, will probably, you know, I wonder what the founders would have thought of that today. Would that be something that's in your home, right? Is that, you know, even though it's on Google servers, it feels like that. So I think that's the a big difference. But nevertheless, law enforcement has been able to use those tools very, very effectively as well in order to track people down. And so it's a really interesting question. And yeah, for facial recognition, faces are also a public thing. When we're out in public, that's how we recognize each other. And we're born to recognize faces. So I kind of put it in a different category. And I think people who are really concerned about privacy kind of fall into two camps. One, you know, just people who care about privacy, and two, people who are really worried about law enforcement abuses, right? Mm. And when there's people that have concerns, or it's about law enforcement abuse, I think there's just stronger controls you put in place, stronger regulations that can kind of soften that.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that framing before, and I think mm-hmm. it's a useful one to consider. What are, you know, customer expectations, right? The framing of, you know, when we talk about privacy, and in fact, this conversation sort of flowed this way, right? Mm-hmm. Is when we're talking about privacy concerns, are we talking about, you know, concerns about the availability of personal information generally, or to, you know, companies and their use of personal information, or are we talking about concerns about law enforcement
abuses? And then when you look at the purpose of the data, what are you using it for, right? We're taking public info and we're helping law enforcement identify criminals and victims of crime. And I think that when people realize it's used for that after the fact, they tend to be more fans of the technology because it gives them that, oh, wow, that's a really kind of great use of it. So yeah, what's the intent of, you know, people using the data when it comes, you know, there's an expectation of privacy, but also with this information, there's, I think, always gonna need to be an exception for governmental usage. It's just, it's too important for them. And if one of these agencies, just one field office said, without ClearView, in 1 year of usage, they made 70 arrests of pedophiles. That would have never been made otherwise. So I think it's kind of a hard thing to be against the technology in this kind of use case. I think we all can agree that, not all agree, but we can think about the trade-offs. If you're trading a little bit of privacy for a lot of security, so law enforcement, or perhaps it's getting access to your bank account, right? Going into a bank, unlocking your phone, people are okay with that. And that's another point. Like when we looked at this technology, we looked at all these different applications that were possible, building security, convenience things like checking into your hotel, and law enforcement had like the best trade-offs. Like I told you the stories, I came back a week later, here's 20 people we can identify. And that's what got us really excited. I think it's the best and highest purpose of facial recognition technology.
Mm-hmm. Is that the sole application right now for ClearView? Is the law enforcement?
I mean, facial recognition is used in other things too, like every day for your iPhone, since iPhone.
No, I meant for ClearView.
Yeah, for us, yeah. And another thing is like, I just something that as long as I'm running the company, we'll never have a consumer-facing app that anyone can download and use, right? Everything has to have a purpose. And I think that this purpose of this technology to help identify criminals and save a lot of time in law enforcement, it helps the victims, it helps make everyone safe, is a really good one to have. It's just very unclear if there was a consumer app out there, what it would be used for. In fact, it might be used for the opposite purpose, someone who could be a child predator, identifying who family members are. And I think that that's something we're very committed to, you know, getting the best out of the tech.
Great. I see that we are now at the time for questions from the audience. So I'm going to look over to direct people to the mic. Yeah. So I think probably due to COVID concerns, we're probably not walking with a mic, but if you have a question, please step up to the microphone and love to hear from you.
Hi, thanks so much for being here. I'm a fellow at both Codex at the Center for Legal Technology and also at HAI working on human-centered AI. And I also work at the Digital Civil Society Lab on right to freedom of association and expression and also anti-surveillance. And I'm wondering how you see ClearView in the hands of authoritarian regimes where maybe distinguishing who's a good guy and who's a bad guy isn't as simple as you make it seem here, and also where the checks and balances in terms of just regulating it better may not be as effective. So I would be curious of how you see that in addition to the obvious questions of bias in facial recognition technology, where there's also ample research at this point by scholars like Joy Bulamwini at Harvard. So I'm just curious how you think about this.
Yeah, thanks for the question. You know, when we were on the front page of the New York Times, we're only 10 full-time employees, right? So we're about 44 or 45 now, so there's a lot of things that, you know, we had to deal with. One of those was we had some demo accounts for non-US law enforcement. That all started at a child crimes conference where people would see how US law enforcement was using ClearView to solve cases. Nevertheless, we're only in the United States right now because we want to get the model right here in terms of responsible use before we go overseas with it. And one thing that's interesting is because this technology is somewhat inevitable in the way China is deploying it overseas, a good question is, like, do you want to have that application of facial recognition in all these other countries, or would you rather have an investigative, forensic, you know, after-the-fact application of it in other countries? We never want this to be used to violate anyone's human rights, right? So it's very important that whatever country you're selling to understands and you know, kind of has the right kind of best practices in place for responsible usage. So it just depends on the country, but it's something that I think is really interesting in terms of making sure that I think as a country, we have a chance to kind of export the right way of doing investigations, export the way we have, you know, expectations of innocence, right, and things like that. So we can export all those values through the technology instead of having China export how they do it everywhere. So it's still early days, but I think it's a really interesting thing. And I think that what we've seen in the US in terms of getting the best out of it while minimizing the worst is exciting.
Do you want to talk about the bias question as well?
Oh, yeah, sure. I think, again, we've had other independent tests talk about how we would run the first issue with the bias one was the ACLU did a test about 2 or 3 years ago saying, okay, here is every member of Congress and here's 25,000 arrest mugshots. And 26 of them were misidentified and the high proportion of those were non-white people. We've done a similar test ourselves and have shown zero racial bias in our algorithm. And we're going to continue to submit to all different tests. Just because you also solve the racial bias issue doesn't mean that you have solved issues with policing. So I think I'm very confident to say that this app works very well across all demographics. It's much better than the human eye. You know, eyewitness lineups account for 70% of wrongful convictions. And when I talk to friends who are people of color, and they see ClearView and it can find them out of billions of photos, I ask them, would you rather this or a lineup? And they all say, yeah, I'd rather use ClearView, right? So that accuracy part can be solved with technology, but it doesn't mean that you might be able to solve all the systemic issues in policing. But the more you dig into it, I think it's an invention like body cameras. Body cameras have been very good overall for reducing police violence. And I think same with facial recognition. It's going to prevent misidentifications. I ask people, would you rather have someone put out a description, like the race of the person, the height of the person, do they have tattoos or not, who just robbed the bank, and have police cars trying to find that person, which is going to create a lot of police interactions that could end badly? Or would you rather actually identify them positively? I think that number two is what I think everyone can agree on.
Thanks. I'll go to this mic over here.
Hello, my name's Afi Blackshear. I'm a 2L at the law school, and I say I'm a privacy nerd, so I have quite a few questions, but I think I'm primarily wondering about primarily Clayton and Juan,
yep.
Your conceptions of privacy, especially with this facial recognition technology, does it only extend to how law enforcement might use this? Clayton, you started this off talking about the awesome utility that this facial recognition can have when it comes to dating apps. I can search people, or I don't know my dating apps, people I'm walking down the street. These sound like some more substantial privacy issues that I'm more concerned with than law enforcement, particularly when, especially if we're talking about January 6th, the law enforcement doesn't really need facial recognition technology. They have, I think, most of the criminals that they found from the criminal activity from January 6th was from cell phone data. That's much more robust and accurate from my understanding. So I'm just curious, where your line of privacy starts and stops, and what are the reasonable steps that law enforcement, and also just if it gets out of law enforcement into consumer hands, what are those reasonable steps look like to preserve the, you know, privacy that a lot of us are concerned about, while also being able to search people I'm dating? I don't know.
I am waiting eagerly for the private use facial recognition app. I mean, I'll tell you this, I'll make a bet right now. I think 10, maybe 15 years tops, we will all be carrying this technology in our pockets. I don't know, I'm old enough to remember the first time that I used Google, which maybe some people are and some people aren't here. But, you know, as soon as you did it, you just knew, oh yeah, like this is the future, this is it, you know, it's happening. The same thing the first time I used facial recognition technology. I was like, yep, this is happening. We're all going to have this, and it's going to be kind of awesome, you know? I think the tension, obviously, is a little more difficult to resolve when you are dealing with, you know, invasions of privacy that result from interactions between people. But I'll say, you know, many, many of the things that people seem very uncomfortable with their government having information about them, you know, that kind of information about them, they are perfectly happy to blast out over, you know, Instagram or Twitter, or to submit to, you know, Alexa listening to them all the time. And it maybe is one of those questions that just sort of resolves itself naturally based on what people are willing to. I would use it all the time.
So yeah, I appreciate the question, and that's why, you know, we really focus on giving it to law enforcement and ensuring that it's used properly, because we just want to make sure we get the best out of it. Yeah, we're exclusively for law enforcement, and it's used exclusively on after the crime investigations. I can tell you that FBI and other people who've used it for the January 6th riots, they were able to identify a lot of the people there. I can put you in touch with them if you want. It was a very effective tool. So if you compare this to what happened, say, previously for the Boston Marathon bombing, where they couldn't identify him for 14 days, there were all these tips coming in. So they're chasing leads that weren't there. They arrested a few of the wrong people. And after that, he shot somebody as well, and then they finally got him. 14 days, right? In this case, when you have an insurrection, you have so many people that were able to identify hundreds of them, and we're talking about hours. So it's through facial recognition. Like FBI and many other people using ClearView AI also with facial recognition to identify these people. So a lot of the time someone could have a burner phone, or maybe they didn't bring a cell phone and other stuff. Where did that come from? People were posting it online publicly. Right, so it's definitely a tool. You can talk to these agents in the field, in the FBI, in Homeland Security, and the rest, who swear by the tool in terms of it being able to crack a lot of cases that wouldn't have been done otherwise. So me personally, and how I view the technology, I think it's a really good safety and security technology. I personally think that's the best and highest use of it. Will there be other things? And people use facial recognition for, I think, ID verification could be a very good use case. People are doing that now. To verify bank accounts when you open something on Coinbase, when you open something on Airbnb. So identity theft is a huge problem where you have people taking your information, if you care about your privacy, making a fake ID with their face, and then going to take over your bank account, right? So facial recognition is being used today by other companies to help prevent that from happening. I think that just from what I've seen, having built a lot of software for different purposes, this is a very good purpose and just very effective for catching people at the Capitol riots.
Thanks. We'll go back to this, Mike.
Thank you very much for educating us in depth on privacy. Really appreciate you taking the time to do that. It seems we've just been recently confronted with an issue of voters' rights versus privacy. Mark Zuckerberg, we just learned, gave $419 million through two organizations to target specific candidates in specific districts. And it seems to me that voters' rights are at stake, because obviously $419 million was probably more than a lot of the other voters could spend. On the other hand, Mark Zuckerberg has a right to privacy. So I'd appreciate the panel's comments on that trade-off between voters' rights and privacy rights.
I'm not an expert.
Clayton. What do you think? I'm going to throw that to you. I know you, I mean, you mentioned that you don't think that...
I don't like the idea that people have to disclose money that they get.
I know, yeah.
I'm not sure if this is exactly on point. So let me see if I understand what you're getting at here. Do you think that it was improper for Mark Zuckerberg to give money to candidates at such a disproportionately high rate?
You're asking me to answer my own question. So I don't know. I really, because he has a right to privacy. On the other hand, he really essentially disenfranchised a lot of people who don't have $419 million to give to people. I'm told that the Republican campaign for the presidency had a total of $1.3 billion to spend. So it seems he had a disproportionate impact on the election. So I can't answer my own question, which is why I'm asking you to answer.
Is that true, though, that he had a disproportionate impact on the election? I guess I'm not so sure that I think, you know, money in a super PAC, which presumably this is how this was spent, not directly to the candidates, because I think that would probably violate a trillion.
Well, that's the point. See, he got around the election laws to give the money. Well, he has the right to give the money. And the only reason we discovered it is because some investigative reporter or attorney or whatever found out that he avoided violating election laws.
By donating to a super PAC.
By donating through two super PACs and only to specific targets. So it wasn't like he gave to the Democrats or the Republicans for that matter, but he gave with specific requirements that it go to these districts. So basically he was directing the money to accomplish, you know, his purposes.
Well,
it seems to me that involves an issue of voter integrity, which you can define as voters' rights, because other people weren't spending $419 million.
You know, I'm not certain that I believe that money in a super PAC really equates to, you know, dollar to vote. I just haven't really seen anything that convinces me that's really true. There's really that pervasive of a connection there. And maybe there is, and maybe there isn't. I guess his privacy right didn't hold up in this context.
Yeah, this is a panel on privacy. Mm. I don't think any of us have answers.
I agree with you, Clayton. Mm. I'm not sure I see that's a voter right issue. But also, that was one of the dissent's view in that Americans for Prosperity case. That's what they were concerned with. They were very concerned with these PACs and the ability to donate large amounts of money. And I just don't have that concern.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the way I'd answer that is that privacy comes up in now virtually every context, mm-hmm. you know, including elections. And so the privacy rights and the degree to which an individual may have them or assert them depends on the other issues that are involved in the case. So in this case, you know, there's quite a lot of precedent now in terms of, you know, trying to balance these issues of voters' rights and, you know, freedom of association mm-hmm. and privacy in this space versus, you know, the public's need to know and have transparency on
right.
to, these types of large donations to avoid manipulation and things like that. So very complicated. I think it's one of the most complicated issues that we have today. So thanks for raising it. Appreciate it. I have time for one last question on this mic.
Hi, my name is Tiranush Babahanova. I'm a biophysics PhD student, and I'm wondering about your opinion about, I'm going to talk about DNA, but not in the sense of personal genomes, but rather new organisms or organisms that can be used as bioweapons. So bioweapons were banned during Nixon administration because it was too easy to make them. If in case of nuclear weapons, you can use satellite data to see which country is organizing a production of enriched uranium, let's say, then in bioweapon case, a student, high school student in current age can use their knowledge to synthesize, let's say, smallpox, which sequence of which is available online. And in fact, in 2017, Canadian team showed that with $100,000 without specialist knowledge, they can revive horsepox, which is an analog, also extremely dangerous, and basically can't spread it, but they, of course, destroyed it. It was just like a proof of principle that we can do this. And what is your opinion about kind of having a tracking mechanism of who submits what kinds of sequences that can potentially be dangerous to vast, like the whole planet, if they end up very easily synthesizing those and creating those viruses, but any bioweapon agents?
So
So is the question specifically about
freedom of speech within the like looking up what dangerous sequences are there or synthesizing them and having some sort of organization that monitors what sequences are submitted to synthesizing companies to be synthesized in order to be engineered into organisms that can be used as bioweapons, which is very easy.
I think that's an interesting question. I don't know how easy it would be. If I looked at that, it would just look like a different language. I would have no idea what it means. But this came up a few years ago when there was a company that showed the directions on how to 3D print a gun online. And the question became, is this a First Amendment issue or not? Should being able to take it down, should they have that right? It's a complicated, complicated question when you have that ability to, you have the instruction manual for things that can be very dangerous to many people. I really err on the side of First Amendment in many cases, but I wouldn't know what that would lead to in terms of geosequencing.
I sure would like to have a closer look at what happened in that lab in Wuhan.
That raised the question of bioweapons, of course, over the past year.
I mean, that may, you know, maybe that experience has sort of called for greater scrutiny of this kind of research. You know, something that's been pretty obscure before and it's very personal now. But I'm not sure I have the right answer for you.
Thanks.
Yeah, certainly after the last year, I think I'd be in favor. But, yeah. You know, I don't have any level of expertise on that. Sorry. Anyway, I'm sorry.
I got a nice question that's
okay.
Relevant.
All right.
Okay.
Last one.
I've worked as an entrepreneur and as a political campaign manager. And in both settings, I wanted to have conversations with people that I knew were private. I would meet people on the side of the road that jump in my car, would go for a ride, would talk. Because it would be disadvantageous to me if people found out what I was going to do before I did it. I'm not a criminal. So therefore, these stories that I hear that there's only two kinds of people concerned about privacy, criminals and those who have a fetish. Ridiculous. I'm an American. We are taught to have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Thank you. Your thoughts, Nick.
Thank you. All right.
Well, I'm definitely not a criminal.
Right. I think that's it. Okay, thank you very much. I don't want to get in the way of lunch. I appreciate your attention.